We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to complete this tradition, insha'Allah, to the best of our ability. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
Debate.
It is a scene that has been played out in U.S. history for the past decades, U.S. mass shootings. Not that shooting deaths don't take place in the U.S. almost on a daily basis. Basic question, why doesn't the U.S. government act on preventing this in a meaningful way? This has put new pressure on the U.S. President Joe Biden to deliver on the gun control promises that he made as a candidate. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether he will be able to beat the gun lobby in the U.S. while preserving the U.S. Second Amendment in the right to own guns. Let's get the latest from our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Colin, obviously, these two mass shootings that have taken place, which there are actually more than just the two based on the research that was done. Tell us how the country's coping with it, and tell us, of course, how this, again, has become a GOP issue, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, the country is still mourning the loss of life from Atlanta and also in Boulder, Colorado. The country tries to figure out what it's going to do next and knows that it's in a stuck position because gun control is never a popular topic. It, like you alluded to, is also partisan. Right now, Democrats seem prepared to try to push through some gun control legislation. However, they're getting a lot of pushback from their GOP counterparts, where you have the National Rifle Association, a very big gun lobby that influences the votes for GOPers. And also you have their voters who believe that it's a Second Amendment issue and that to ban any assault weapon is an infringement on those rights. So we're going to see a balancing act by the current president to try to suggest legislation that will satisfy the crisis that's going on in America, but also something that saves Second Amendment and doesn't break up Second Amendment rights.
Thank you very much for that, Colin Campbell, correspondent there from Washington, D.C. All right, let me bring in Gerald Horn, who's an author and professor of history, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Gerald Horn, welcome. It has not been a good week for the U.S. when it comes to mass shootings. Now, we thought that there were actually two mass shootings that took place in a span of 1 week. It turns out that there's been seven of them in the past week. I don't even know if you're aware of that. Mass shooting definition, the death of four more people in one sitting or in one incident. What's your initial reaction to what has happened? Of course, the two major ones that have been advertised or somewhat shown all over the TV screens across America.
Well, tragically and sadly, mass shootings in the United States are hardly news. It's like a story in the newspaper on the front page that says, dog bites man. This is a reflection of the long and tragic and unfortunate history of the United States, a settler colonial project that was based upon enslavement of Africans and dispossession of the Native Americans. And the settlers made sure that they were armed to the teeth and likewise made sure that arms were not allowed into the hands of the enslaved Africans nor the Native Americans. That was encoded in the U.S. Constitution under the now fabled Second Amendment, which your correspondent mentioned. And thus far, there has been not a successful effort to reinterpret the Second Amendment in order to make sure that guns do not proliferate and allow for these kinds of mass shootings dramatically seen in Atlanta, Georgia, and Boulder, Colorado.
The reinterpretation of the Second amendments something that could be done? Has it been promoted? Any acts on it that you're aware of?
Well, it's promoted all the time. But what happens is that the lawyers lose in court, not least because the right wing has made sure that the courts are packed with ultra-conservatives who agree with their narrow interpretation of the Second Amendment. Now, what's interesting is that even today, in 2021, there seems to be a footnote to the Second Amendment. Recall that in 1967, when the Black Panther Party went into the legislative chambers in Sacramento, California, the California State Legislature, armed to the teeth, even the National Rifle Association, even the gun lobby, even then Republican Governor Ronald Wilson Reagan cried out and clamored for gun control. It seems that the only way we'll have gun control in this country is if we can show that it's Black people arming. Otherwise, I'm afraid to say we're doomed.
Okay, let me bring in Malik Abdul, GOP strategist and commentator from Washington, D.C. Malik Abdul, welcome. The reaction by the U.S. president in one respect has been, I don't need to wait another minute. This is a quote from him. Let alone an hour to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future. And I urge my colleagues, he said, in the House and Senate to act on one bill, broaden background checks for gun buyers. Do you think that will cut the mass shootings that take place in the U.S.?
I don't. I think the biggest problem is this misconception or conflation of ideas of what it is when we're referring to when we say mass shootings. According to the federal government itself, mass shootings are identified as any shooting that involves four or more people, where the victims are four or more people. So any shootings, I live in Washington, D.C., and we've had many mass shootings in D.C., unfortunately. What happens is that the incident like what happened in Atlanta or what happened in Boulder, Colorado, those become the faces and the perception that people have of what mass shootings. The United States definitely has a problem with gun violence, but it's not mass shootings, and it's not because of the lack of background check. Overwhelmingly, the majority of the violence associated with guns are not those that fail to pass a background check. There may be other loopholes in laws that allows that type of stuff, but it's not banning, assault rifles or even what the suggestion is as far as background checks. We don't know anything about what happened in the Boulder, Colorado shooting that links it to some deficiency or some problem with our gun laws.
Well, Biden has also said, Colin, the fact that what's going on here is a ban on assault rifles need to come in place, and also high-capacity ammunition magazines. Because in the U.S. mass shootings, almost each case involves the type of weapon like an AK-47, and these weapons are designed to kill, and they do kill. Why don't they just ban it?
Well, I think that the United States actually tried something like that before when they had the assault weapons ban. And there are various studies that some show that there were, you can get a study to prove whatever you want, but some studies show that it actually decreased the incidence of mass shootings. But again, we have to go back to defining what mass shootings are. You can look at any of the cities in our countries, particularly our urban environments, and see constant incidents, whether it's Chicago, Baltimore, New York, LA. You see so many instances of mass shootings, but they're never defined as such because it doesn't fit the particular narrative that we have, not just about mass shootings, but who are the perpetrators of mass shootings, because in this case, we know what happened in contrast to what people are saying around the country or what the assumption was. This person who in Colorado was not a white supremacist. He was not white at all. He was Middle Eastern.
Okay. Let's break that open a little bit, Gerald Horn. Our guests there just referred to white supremacists, and in this case, he mentioned Middle Eastern. The U.S. president has come out saying that America does have a problem with white supremacists. Do you think that the profile, for example, of the one that killed the responsible for the deaths of the Asians fit the profile of a white supremacist? And then in turn, why is it that the U.S. has this kind of problem that results, in the case of the Asians, in deaths?
Well, With regard to the second point first, you may consult history and recognize that whenever the United States is in a crisis with a major Asian power, such as with Japan in the 1940s, or with China today, you see a backlash against Asian Americans. In the 1940s, you might recall 120,000 Japanese Americans were interned in concentration camps before the dropping of atomic weapon on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. Today, you see intensified criticism and hostility towards the People's Republic of China. And as a direct result of this kind of rhetoric, you see hostility towards Asian Americans. You need only look at the 45th U.S. president and his rhetoric towards China, referring to the coronavirus as Kung Flu or the Chinese virus. And there has been a spectacular uptick in hate crimes against Asian Americans in the last few years. I was just listening to a congressional hearing this morning with regard to white supremacy in the United States. It's infiltrated the 18,000 plus U.S. police departments. It's infiltrated the highest levels of the U.S. military. The Pentagon chief, Lloyd Austin, who happens to be a black American, called for a pause last month in order to deal with the question of white supremacy and white racial vigilantism in the highest ranks of the U.S. military. So anyone who denies that this is a problem basically is ignoring the reality.
Malik Abdul, do you agree? Do you think that the U.S. does have a problem with white supremacists in cases leading to deaths based on, let's say, guns that have been used as a weapon?
The U.S. has a race problem. The U.S. has a white supremacy problem. The U.S. has a bigotry, stereotyping. And there are so many problems that the U.S. has. But again, it's how we frame these discussions. This is not my opinion. If you go and look at many of the articles that are circulating, particularly in the San Francisco, L.A., Oakland area, where the Asian community itself has been speaking for months, almost even for a year now, about the type of violence that's committed against them. This is something that I just recently talked about itself. Go and look at what they're talking about, the instances, four of which, even in New York just recently, there was another instance of an Asian, actually he wasn't, he was South Asian, he was attacked on the New York subway. Those instances are actually the perpetrators of those of that violence were black men. In each of those instances, if you go and look at the reports that the Asian community itself is saying, the attackers themselves are black men, but we never hear conversations about the race when it's black, or even in the instance of what happened in Colorado, where they're talking about Middle Eastern. It's how we frame the discussion. Absolutely. A nation that was essentially built on the backs of slavery, of course we have an issue with racism. We even have an issue with white supremacy. What we don't know, particularly in the case of what happened in Atlanta, is whether or not this guy had any type of racial or ethnic motivation in his shootings. He was criticized, and I think many people were questioning, why was this a discussion about he had a sex addiction? Well, that's what he said. It's up to the investigators to find out exactly what in, whether or not race had in, played a role in those killings. But right now, we don't know that. But what we are doing is having a discussion about that guy in Atlanta being a white supremacist without any information but our opinion on it.
Well, Malik Abdul, let's see what lawmakers are saying about this, because obviously they always come out, as is customary, and they put their statements forward. For example, Senator Ted Cruz, who's a Republican, he criticized Democrats for ridiculous theater, called for universal background checks and other measures. And he also said after the grocery store killing in Colorado that gun control does not lessen crime, it makes it worse. Your reaction to his statement?
Yeah, I'm not. I live in a city where guns
This is for Gerald Horn. I'm sorry. I'll come to you in a second.
Ahead.
Sorry about that. Gerald Horn, go ahead.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that Senator Ted Cruz of Texas makes such a statement. After all, Texas has one of the bloodiest histories in the history of the United States with regard to routing and genocidal approaches to Native Americans, particularly the Comanche people, who hardly exist nowadays. Mr. Cruz, of course, is reflecting that kind of ideology when he comes out four square against gun control. I think that what we're facing in the United States is a kind of Russian roulette. Whenever you go to a supermarket or whenever you step outside your door, you run the risk of being shot down. And of course, if you're black, even if you're in your home, as the case of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky tended to suggest, You can have the police in a no-knock raid break down your door and shoot you in your bed. This is the kind of society run amok that we're now facing and enduring in the United States of America.
Another statement made by Senator Ted Cruz, Malik Abdul, is he said, what happens in this committee after every mass shooting is that the Democrats propose taking away guns from law-abiding citizens because that's their political objective. Do you agree with him?
I do believe that there are Democrats, many Democrats, who are anti-gun, anti-Second Amendment. I actually do believe that. But we do know, because politics rules the day, whenever there's an instance of gun violence, we always get to a discussion about restrictions on gun violence. And in many of those, whether it was the Sandy Hook shooting, or even the Parkland shooting in Florida, we see so many of these instances where the things that politicians are proposing are not related to the actual case. So I think in many ways, Democrats use these mass shootings as an opportunity to further their agenda, which in many ways seek to restrict guns. On the conservative side, of course, when it comes to Second Amendment rights, the NRA or anything like that, you'll be hard-pressed to find Republicans who are pro gun restrictions, but I think that has more to do with the politics of our country, and the same way that you'll be hard-pressed to find anyone supportive of teachers unions, supportive of things that they believe will harm teachers. We exist in tribes in the United States, and most of our discussions are you're either red, blue, black, white, and this is another example of that.
Throughout the course of this debate, Gerald Horn, I'm getting the feeling that, I mean, on the one hand, yes, it's about the rifle, or it's about the type of, or it's about the gun that's being used to kill people. But then it's the motivation or the incentive behind it. And then that forays into these different arteries, like racism, like ideologies that person who has the gun has, whether it's hatred for blacks, for Middle Eastern people of Middle Eastern descent, or what have you. So how can I pose the question where is it the person's fault for going about obviously doing the killing, or is it the fact that he has become or she has become a victim of the surrounding of what America is, and the way to let out the anger, hatred, etc., is by taking a gun and doing the killing?
Well, ultimately, it's the latter. Ultimately, you have to lay this crime at the door of society. You may have some like-minded citizens or like-minded persons in Iran or Japan or London, but if guns are curtailed, they're not able to act upon their particular sentiments. The problem we have in the United States is that people who oftentimes face mental challenges, like the young man in Boulder, Colorado, or the young man in Atlanta, Georgia, are able to act upon their demented sentiments by getting weapons in their hands and then acting out. Plus, we need to realize that this is not just a U.S. problem. There's been a substantial amount of journalism in this country about how there is a profitable small arms industry, and that a river of guns are exported into Mexico, into Central America, that helps to arm drug cartels, and also leads to an escalation of the murder rate in Mexico, which has led to diplomatic interventions by the government of Mexico City with regard to their counterparts in Washington. So this is spreading and proliferating, and something really needs to be done sooner rather than later.
Yeah, the illegal arms trade is obviously always something that has been there. It's a moneymaker. Okay, time to talk about the NRA, which you mentioned in one of your statements, Malik Abdul-Amin. What is the role that the NRA is playing here? It bragged about blocking the AR-15 gun ban right before the Boulder shooting. The NRA actually celebrated the ruling as a victory on its website and then and on its social media last week. And then 10 people were killed and massacred just 10 days later.
Yeah, this is, as I said, when it comes to the NRA, they are going to support the Second Amendment without any restrictions. That's what they do. That's the organization that they are. In the instance of the Boulder, Colorado shooting, and I was reading just before I came on the show here, we still do not know if
the gun, if there were any type of gun loopholes that this guy was able to take advantage of that resulted in where we are now. But we are having a discussion on gun restrictions. From what we know, at least as for what we've been reporting in the news, this guy didn't seem to have any type of racial resentment or anything like that, but he was able to have access to the gun. How? We don't know that at the point. He could have a legal gun. You know, he could have procured that legally. We just don't know. But in places all around the country, what we're really dealing with isn't just who has access to the guns. It's the personal irresponsibility of people who choose to take advantage of people, slaughtering them, murdering them in our streets. The personal responsibility, a lot of that, sometimes we don't have those discussions because we would rather talk about the politics of the day. No, guns literally don't kill people. The people who use those guns are the ones who kill people, and we need to start dealing with that as forcefully as we're dealing with the issues of how to actually make us have a better society where we are able to have some sort of restrictions on guns, even if that's something like background checks. We need to be able to have those conversations. But if the only thing that we're going to do is jump to our sides, blame Trump, blame Republicans, we're never going to get anywhere at all.
So how do we get somewhere, or how does the U.S. get somewhere, Gerald Horn, in less than a minute to stop the mass shootings of taking place? What can be done?
Well, first of all, with regard to the National Rifle Association, it's a sink of corruption. It's being investigated by the Attorney General of New York State. A number of members are complaining about how the leaders have used their dues to bankroll lush and lavish lifestyles. It would not surprise me if the NRA would be driven out of business sooner rather than later. And I would say, thank goodness. That would be one giant step towards getting some sort of sanity with regard to gun control. And certainly we need more state measures in states like California, states like Connecticut, for example, which was the scene of a mass shooting a few years ago under President Obama, where a number of school children were slaughtered in their classrooms. And if that did not lead to gun control, it's hard to see what will lead to gun control. But I'm afraid to say that this kind of Russian roulette that I've made reference to continues to escalate. And until we're able to do something about the right-wing and Republican control of Congress, which forbids sane gun control measures, I'm afraid to say this Russian roulette will continue.
All right, so I can give you 30 seconds, if I may, Malik Abdul, a response to our guest's comments there. 30 seconds, please.
On the issue of Russian roulette, again, as someone who lives in Washington, D.C., our uptick in gun violence last year had nothing to do with Donald Trump, nothing to do with the NRA. I live in a city that's run by Democrats. Our violence, our crime, our education, all of that is under Democratic control, and I don't spend my time blaming the mayor of the city for what's happening here. Personal responsibility, irresponsibility is what we're really talking about, okay. And if we want to have a forward discussion, let's go there.
Yes, we definitely will. I think the U.S., within the U.S., there will be. Thank you. Colin Campbell, our guest at the top of the hour from Washington, D.C., spoke to us. Malik Abdul just now, GOP strategist and commentator, thank you. And also Gerald Horn, many thanks, author and professor of history, spoke to us from Houston. That is for this edition of The Debate. Thanks. Until next time.
Allama Hassanzada Amuli is not only actually a philosopher, but a very comprehensive scholar that we have. And he is amazingly expert in many different fields of Islamic studies, and not only Islamic studies, but also different branches of sciences, for example, mathematics.
We always need a teacher, and especially in the field of mysticism, you yes. cannot obviously grow unless until you have a teacher. So we definitely need a teacher. Mm-hmm. And the way he had his own teachers, the way he remembered his teachers, and the way he talks about his teachers obviously shows that the role of teacher was very important in his life.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher, which is an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. Namely, for this episode, we want to talk about Ayatollah Allama Hassan Hassanzadeh Amali. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Reza Zadeh, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
You're welcome. So in our previous episode regarding the life of Allama Hassanzadeh Amali, we talked about, we can say, different fields of studies in which he is expert. Also his mentors and his teachers, including the late Allama Sha'rani as the most important figure, and also the role that the spirituality and high spirituality might have in producing such an scholar, such a high caliber scholar like Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali. In this episode, we want to talk about philosophy as regarded by Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali. Let's start with you, Dr. Rezazadeh. It seems that philosophy in the Western terminology and definition is very much different from the hikmah and the falsafa, which is regarded by scholars like Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali. They are different, I mean, philosophy and hikmah. What's Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali exactly saying regarding philosophy for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One thing very unique and interesting about the view of Allama Hassanzadeh Amali to philosophy, to the world, to the mysticism, is that he has an opinion that is much more inclusive. Mm-hmm. You know, many people, when they look at the different branches of sciences, and even and not only sciences and philosophy and mysticism and different things that seem to be different, they look at the differences and they see a lot of contradictions and conflicts between different sciences, and sometimes say, yeah, this is in contradiction with that and these are not in line with each other. Allama Hassanzadeh Amali in most cases has a different approach to this phenomena, and he says when it comes to the philosophy, just like many other philosophers, he says that philosophy is the science or the knowledge that cares about the reality of the things.
That's right.
So this is a very general definition of, yes, the philosophy. The real philosophy and philosophers, they concern knowing the things, what is the reality of everything.
That's right.
Including the physical and material things.
That's right.
But going on to the more deeper parts, yes, of the existence. So he says there is no contradiction when it comes to the sciences, and it goes up and up to the philosophy and to the mysticism. He says these are different, okay, levels of the same thing.
So philosophy and Irfan are in the same path.
Exactly, okay, but these are different levels of the same,
that's,
thing.
Right.
For example, okay, a scholar, a scientist, tries to know the reality of the physical phenomena.
Yes.
This is, according to this idea, this is a part of philosophy, which is, but it is much lower than the higher level, okay, of philosophy that goes deeper and deeper, uh-huh, to know the reality, so which and the secrets, right, behind these, okay, physical things. Mm-hmm. And it goes upper and upper to go to the level that is called mysticism,
that's right,
which is the deepest parts and realities and secrets of the things, including the non-physical and non-material,
that's right,
phenomena.
So according to
Allama, okay, these are different stages and
so
levels.
So unlike
of
some scholars, some other, we can say, scholars and Muslim thinkers, he does not negate philosophy totally, because some of,
absolutely,
them avoid philosophy totally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And this is why he does not see any contradiction between, unlike many scholars,
yes,
he does not see any contradiction, uh-huh, between the philosophy that has come from Greece, and,
okay,
has been evolved in Islam.
Uh-huh.
These are the same, you know.
Yes.
Even if it has started by Aristotle or,
okay,
other Greek philosophers,
yes,
there is no contradiction because they are the same thing.
That's right.
They started something,
okay,
and it was evolved and completed,
yes,
By Muslim scholars,
and the level is different.
Absolutely,
yes. And he names, of course, Mullah Sadra and Ibn al-Arabi. We can,
yes,
say. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, I think this is the main difference between the philosophy and the hikmah that is understood by Allama Hassanzadeh Amali, and the philosophy that others understand. Because we have still some scholars who have negative approaches toward philosophy. They do not believe in that. They say the only source is Quran and Hadith, Of course, they are very much significant and they are very much important, but they are negating the whole trend of philosophy. But it seems that Allama Hasanzada Omali believes in philosophy as one true field of study which can be discussed seriously.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as far as it is concerned to Allama Hasanzada Omali, basically he is one of the promoters of philosophy in the Hawza, in the yes. Islamic seminary. Allama Hasanzadeh and there are other philosophers like Allama Tabatabai or yes. Allama Jawadi Amali, or we have Ayatollah Miswa Yazdi. These all people who were very much involved in the philosophy, especially in the Islamic seminary.
Yes.
Because when we talk in the Islamic seminary about in regards to the people who are involved in the philosophy, these names comes
to the scene.
To the scene.
Yes. Allama Jafari also was.
Allama Jafari yes. also. Now the point which you made that what's the difference? What's the difference between having the Islamic philosophy, or is the origin of Islamic philosophy
yes.
is
the Greek philosophy?
Greek philosophy. Allama Tabatabai in one of his books. Obviously, it's in Persian, Islam, the Insan and Ma'asir, which
right.
is the Islam and the man of the time.
Or the contemporary man.
Contemporary man.
That's right.
And also the Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi in his book, Philosophical Instruction,
yes.
page 33, where he's talking about the history of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
They both have mentioned that at the time of Ahlul Bayt, when Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas were there, they started to translate the Greek philosophy, and they brought the Greek philosophy into the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it because, obviously, they were against Ahlul Bayt, and
yes.
they did not want the teachings of Ahlul Bayt to be spread.
Okay.
Now, here we can conclude two things from this point. Number one, the philosophy was in Islam,
mm-hmm.
which, obviously, Allama Hasanzadeh also refers to this, because
That's
he does not see any difference between
okay.
these. There are different degrees, there
yes.
are different levels.
Yes, as that
but the
said,
point
that's
is, right. Islam itself, we cannot say like Islam has got philosophy from Greek.
Mm-hmm.
There is an origin of philosophy within Islam. In
mm-hmm.
the Quran, we have
okay.
the philosophy
okay.
in the teachings of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And this part of history explains that, obviously, they brought the Greek philosophy into Islam by translating the books. On top of that, Shahid Mutahri says, we do accept that these things has happened, and Allama Tabatabai also says like these translations has happened in the beginning of in the Islam. But obviously, when the Greek philosophy was there, there were only 200 problems in the philosophy
that were
which were addressed. But
yes.
later, Islam has come and it changed. And it increased the problems. It raised from 200 to 700 problems.
And you mean by problems or the questions?
The questions, yes.
The questions,
the philosophical problems.
Because Islam is not the problem maker, for sure.
No.
That's right. Okay.
Not that kind of problem.
Yeah. Okay.
But obviously, there are different, we can say, like, sayings
That's
in
right.
regards to this.
Okay.
But yes, in the eyes of Allama Hasanzadeh, we can say, like, he do not see any difference because... even in the mysticism and the philosophy, he does not see any difference because he says the main source is the Quran, and we need to learn and we need
yes.
to make Quran the core
yes.
of everything.
Of everything, including philosophy.
Including philosophy.
That's right. He believes in the Holy Quran as the main source for all the philosophies around the world. But, you know...
And he says real philosophy is Quran.
Is
it? Yeah. So because it all depends on how you interpret these things.
No, I mean, does he term it as the real philosophy
yes.
is the
Quran? Yes, يعني Quran. Real philosophy
uh-huh.
means Quran. So,
okay.
you know, he looks at the things very differently,
okay.
and this makes him much more inclusive.
Okay, so the philosophical questions that are tackled by today in the world
mm-hmm.
and by the Western philosophers, I mean
yes.
the Western generation of the philosophers, they can also be answered by the Holy Quran and Islam.
That's why he definitely believes in,
mm-hmm.
because he says the philosophers around the world,
okay.
their concern is to find out
okay.
the answers
mm-hmm.
for foundational questions
mm-hmm.
and also finding the reality of the things and the phenomena that we see in this world.
But it
and we can
right.
find the
okay.
real answers
uh-huh.
to these questions from within the Quran and Sunnah.
Okay.
From the
okay.
words of God and words of the prophets
okay.
and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, these are the best sources to find out the real answers for the questions.
But it does not necessarily mean that we have only be concerned with the Islamic hikmah. we also must know the Western thinking system and the thoughts too, okay?
And this does not mean that we can find the answers to the scientific questions, for example, in physics, from the Quran and the Sunnah, because it's not the mission of the Quran and the Sunnah to provide answers for necessarily scientific problems. Yes. This is something else. But anything that we need to know about the reality of the things that is somehow related to the guidance of the people and to our real needs and real questions, they can be found out in the Quran.
For sure, the source of revelation and wahy is very much different from the philosophical ideas. And what is beautiful about some of the new generation that Sayyid Mohsen mentioned, like Allama Sha'rani, Allama Tabatabai, Ayatollah Misbah, Allama Ja'fari, we can say Ayatollah Javadi Amali and Ayatollah Hasanzada Amali, is that they're trying to find a combination between the two.
Yes.
I mean, at the same time, being concerned with the philosophy in the serious definition, that which is accepted by all the universities all across the world, but at the same time, do not be negligent of the Islamic treasure and the Islamic hikmah which is inside. Yes.
And you know, people like Allama Hasanzada Amali and Allama Tabatabai, and these people who have a much more comprehensive or an inclusive look at the philosophy, they have a better, let's say, engagement with Western philosophy, so they can get in touch with philosophers, with Western philosophers in a better way.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much. And this dialogue is very important.
Yes.
I mean, we should not close all the lines Absolutely. And all the cancer channels to the Western philosophy. As we said in one of our programs, Allama Tabatabai was really fond of having dialogue between himself and Henri Corbin.
Yes.
Because he said the only window and horizon to the Western philosophy now, Western problems of the philosophy, is this man.
Yes.
I have to be familiar. And I think Ayatollah Hasanzada Amali is following the same path. Thank you very much, Dr. Reza Zadeh.
You're very welcome.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi for your presence in the program, The Teacher. This was the program, The Teacher, regarding Ayatollah Hasan Hasanzada Amali and his opinion regarding the field of philosophy or falsafe. Dear listeners, you can visit our website for more information at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam Radio. Also, YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of it? Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The world with reporters.
A new wave of coronavirus has started in the Gaza Strip with over 500 new infections reported on Wednesday. During February, infections were below 100 cases daily. Coronavirus infections have reached over 60,000 cases in the blockaded Gaza Strip, mostly since late August 2020. Nearly 600 deaths have also been reported amid shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, including vaccines. The unsteady supply of medical equipment and testing kits for COVID-19 has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
We are witnessing an alarming increase in the number of daily infections. Coronavirus infections' current daily rate is over 500 cases. The number of patients requiring hospitalization and medical attention is also rising at a fast pace.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
We are afraid that the new coronavirus wave will result in new lockdowns that will only worsen the economic conditions. The situation is also very dangerous because of the high population density in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus is taking a heavy toll on us because of the blockade and the lack of resources. Things are really tough, and we are in an urgent need of medicines, hospital supplies, and vaccines.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector. Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Since early March, infections have started to rise. The first wave of coronavirus ended during February, and at that time the curve of infections was flattened. The results were also stable and the numbers of critical cases were moderate. During March, we started to witness a rapid increase in infections and critical cases.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as COVID-19 infections continue to increase.
The small enclave has been under a crippling blockade since 2007. Experts say the Israeli siege must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date Iran has chosen not to engage. So as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the shorter, medium, and even longer term.
The US continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the US is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
This part of the world has been on the limelight since the last few decades for its impressive growth and development. But the benefits of development are not reaching to its impoverished section. India, the world's second most populous nation and a diverse country, is still struggling to feed millions as hunger continues to be a challenging task for successive governments. For those having tough times to feed themselves, growth and development is just for a TV and a newspaper, since their lives have not changed.
This pandemic has created a humanitarian crisis in India. We saw that with the lockdown, millions of people started walking. Now, all of those people, they suddenly went from earning, 10,000, 15,000 to earning zero and having no savings to fall back on.
Based on the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World 2020 report, there are some 189 million undernourished people in India, which accounts to about a 14% of country's overall population, which includes women and children, putting the future generation of the country at huge stake. Experts say government programs and schemes need a vigorous implementation.
It's also a challenge of A, not having enough coverage within the food security law. So like in a place like Delhi, only 37% of the population has access to rations under that food security law, whereas more than 50% of Delhi lives in slum or slum-like conditions.
India's aim to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals by 2030 includes providing nutrition to all, and ending hunger looks like a challenging task for the country, keeping in view the geography and the population. On the other hand, experts say addressing the stark food inequality and robust distribution system is the most vital way forward. Many reports, surveys, and studies suggest that India has the largest number of undernourished people in the world. However, the government has time and again junked these reports, questioning the methodology of their calculating the hunger index, saying India has made progress in feeding the most deprived over the last decade. Experts, however, say the country needs to strengthen its delivery system and programs to achieve a lasting solution. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The first summit between China and the United States since the election of Joe Biden produced an unexpected and extraordinary diplomatic blow-up. During opening remarks, top U.S. diplomats tried to present China as a global threat, airing a litany of complaints about the way China's government and political culture differs from the West. That breach of diplomatic norms led to an hour of public arguing, which saw China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechi, point out that the U.S. was, quote, massacring the people of other countries and, quote, toppling regimes through the use of force. Yang called the U.S. the champion of cyber attacks, noted that blacks in the U.S. are slaughtered, and asked the U.S. to, quote, stop advancing its own democracy in the rest of the world, a democracy which Yang said many Americans no longer have confidence in. The summit may come to be viewed as the beginning of a new geopolitical era defined by Chinese confidence.
A lot of the, you know, ruling class in the U.S. is very used to thinking of China as like this poor, dominated country that in recent decades has just been a source of cheap labor. And they're really frightened that this country that should have been, you know, dominated and defeated is, you know, standing up as a world power.
Just prior to the summit, Biden placed sanctions on 24 Chinese officials, which may have been designed to end any chances for cooperation even before the meeting began.
The Obama administration's pivot to Asia policy shifted the Pentagon's planning from the Muslim world to China. Biden has continued with an openly antagonistic approach, which rejects Beijing's call for cooperation amid the multiple global crises.
I just think there's so much opposition to cooperation and so much support for a new Cold War that even if Biden wanted to cooperate with China, he couldn't. Like, Trump wanted a peace deal with North Korea, a much less, like, strategic threat to the United States, and Trump wasn't able to get that through.
The talks concluded without the issuance of a final joint statement. Experts in both nations say few should expect a significant improvement in bilateral relations between the two superpowers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we want it to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy, and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community, or per se like the Iranian community, or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition, and that I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is, like, majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival, and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavy damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies that caused the death of tens of thousands of people. Many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say the army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees. A scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed, and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and white